Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, for more information. And, well, this is probably one of the greatest reality shows on Earth. And to have a winner, what an awesome, interesting situation. So I want to welcome the program Ethan Zahn, Survivor winner. Ethan, thanks for calling, man.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And excited to talk to you about a bunch of different things, but tell us a little bit about your background and, I guess, life after Survivor. That'll be very interesting because I think that's where a lot of your work right now helping others stems from in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I was very fortunate enough to be on Survivor Africa and do well and win the game. And with that comes a large sum of money. And because of my time playing soccer in Zimbabwe and witnessing firsthand what was happening with HIV and AIDS, and partnering up with a couple of good soccer buddies of mine, I was able to use some of that money to help co-found a charity called Grassroots Soccer.
Oh, wow. So, okay. So you started that right after almost Survivor ended then, correct?
Yeah, like exactly right after Survivor ended. And, it was just an idea. You know, we figured maybe we can use professional soccer players in Africa to teach kids important life lessons. You know, simple concept. No one was doing it. And we just kind of tried it out and it was working and we developed a great curriculum. And now we're able to be in a bunch of different countries, and we've graduated over 550,000 youth from the program. And we're on target to graduate a million by the year 2014, which is where the World Cup is in Brazil.
Well, that's fantastic. And I guess when you came up with this idea to do this, it must have been very daunting, right, to come up with grassroots soccer, especially when you're talking worldwide in so many ways.
Yeah, I definitely cannot take credit for thinking of the idea. Dr. Tommy Clark had the idea for grassroots soccer, and he partnered with, you know, three other guys, myself, Kirk Friedrich, Matembe and Lovu. We all came together to really create the, you know, grassroots soccer. But it was his idea, and I just helped, you know, try to get it out there as much as possible because I had this great platform coming off Survivor and then heading on to Survivor All-Stars.
Well, and so once you went through the whole process of developing grassroots soccer, tell us specifically how it works. You kind of gave a little bit of an idea, but specifically how it works, the ways they educate, things like that right now, the program.
Yeah, the program is really based on behavior change. We want to change these at-risk youth. We want to change the way they think. We want to change the way they process information and how they make decisions so they can lead a healthy lifestyle. The way we do that is through training professional soccer players, coaches, and peer leaders in the community about HIV and AIDS through our skills curriculum. And then they go into the class to teach the youth about AIDS prevention. Because soccer is the most popular sport in Africa, you know, and every little kid enjoys the game of soccer, both boys and girls. So soccer's the hook, but we're really delivering a health intervention.
So where in Africa is this taking place? What countries?
Well, our three flagship sites are Zimbabwe, Zambia, and South Africa. That's where we have programs running year-round. And we partner with other organizations in about 13 other countries as well.
So for the soccer players that are involved in this, are they all pretty well-known soccer players in those countries that you get to involve the team up with this organization?
Yes and no. We use local professional players, which is good. The guys that grew up in the same streets and kind of made it out. But, the real professionals, you know, sometimes their schedule is a little crazy, so we get them involved as much as possible. But we also have these coaches that we've trained. They're soccer enthusiasts, they know the game of the sport, and they're the ones that see these kids every single day. Some of the pro players will, you know, come once a week or use the prize incentives type thing. We both have male and female professional players, male and female coaches, and students as well, so it's great.
So have you been able to really be hands-on in this organization? Have you gotten many times to travel out to Africa to watch it firsthand?
Early on in the development of grassroots soccer, I was there a bunch. You know, but now as we've grown, we were smart enough to hire people that understand how to run an organization like Grassroots Soccer. But it's nice to know that the four co-founders are still involved. And, you know, now my job is more on kind of U.S.-based awareness and fundraising programs.
And we'll talk about that in just a minute, because I have another interesting question about Grassroots Soccer that's quite interesting. And so you said it's also expanded to other countries. So what other countries are involved now with the same type of programs?
You know, Malawi, where we've been in Uganda, we're in Nigeria, we're in Botswana, we're in, you know, about 13 different countries. I can't rattle them off the top of my head right now, but if you check the website, we have all the countries that we're working with. But it's not like a brick-and-mortar Grassroots Soccer office. We'll go over there, identify a great organization on the ground in this country, and maybe their HIV/AIDS component is lacking a little bit. So we'll come in, we'll partner with them, we'll do a training of trainers courses with our curriculum, make sure it's sustainable for a longer period of time, there's funding there, and then we'll take off.
Quite interesting.
So, no, I mean, not just take off.
Take off. Yeah, take off, meaning like it'll be very successful. Understand completely, Ethan. And I think that it's very amazing sometimes when people win a prize money and become a celebrity, they kind of forget about others. And it's good you're not. You're bringing back, you're giving back, and especially a sport that you love, which is soccer.
Exactly. I mean, I felt that when I was playing the game of Survivor, I was playing their life. $4 million, you know, 39 days out there in the Kenya bush, and I came home with $1 million. You know, they don't get to do that. Plus, coupled with my time playing professionally in Zimbabwe, it just made sense to me, you know.
Oh, so you play professional soccer in Zimbabwe as well?
Yeah. So the kind of the way the story goes, to backtrack a little bit, but Dr. Tommy Clark, myself, Kirk Friedrich, and Matembe and Lou, the founders, we all play for the same team in Zimbabwe called the Highlanders Football Club at different times, but we all played for the same team within a couple of years. So that was our connection, and that's where it started.
Was that before Survivor that you played professional soccer?
Yep, prior to Survivor, I was playing professional soccer, yeah, 99 and 2000 in Zimbabwe. Then I came back, played here in the States for a little bit, and then took off for Survivor.
So it must have been easier understanding Africa's climate in certain ways by playing there?
I guess a little bit, yeah. You know, you can never really prepare for Survivor, but, you know, I was used to the heat, I guess, a little bit, and maybe being a little dehydrated or something. But, you know, we were right in the middle of the bush. You know, when I was playing soccer, I was in a small city, but we were in the middle of nowhere when we played Survivor in the Shaba National Reserve.
So tell me a little bit about, then, specifically the foundation raising money in the United States. There's a big event coming up that you want to promote. So tell us a little bit about that now.
Sure. You know, we have a bunch of fun events that happen throughout the year for Grassroots Soccer, one of which is this LA Fest, which will be taking place in Los Angeles at the Home Depot Center on March 24th. And it's a pretty spectacular event because during the day we have an entertainment industry soccer tournament. So anyone from the entertainment industry, whether you're a production company, a TV show, a PR company, a movie distribution, network, whatever you may be, you can enter a team. And we're actively looking for more teams. We have like 25 now. We want 32. And then that will roll into a celebrity soccer match that evening, which will be hosted by Mia Hamm, Nomar Garcia Parra, and myself, along with a bunch of other, you know, celebrity, I guess, soccer players, I guess you can call them. And we also have a futsal tournament going on during the day. We have a youth tournament or youth clinic going on during the day. So it's just a big, spectacular, fun day full of soccer, all raising money for Grassroots Soccer and the Mia Hamm Foundation.
So that must be really exciting for you and a lot of work but to get to the event, but you can't wait to the day, I'm sure of it.
Lot of work, but yes, hopefully it'll be worth it. You know, we'll raise some money, but more importantly, raise some good awareness too, I think, for the event. And it's going to be fun. It's like a family day. You know, it's going to be a really fun evening. And, you know, the Mia Hamm Foundation supports stem cell donor and getting people registered for that. And Grassroots Soccer is obviously about HIV and AIDS. So it's a good mix. It's going to be a good night.
So how did you connect with Mia? What was that? How did that work, that you, your foundation and hers work together?
Well, every year, Mia Hamm has a celebrity soccer match to raise money for the bone marrow transplant type stuff. So we figured maybe we can just join forces and make it just a big, giant festival. And it's working out so far, so good.
So when you're talking about the people that are involved in the day of tournament soccer,
yes.
So these are people, a lot of people in Hollywood that get involved in this? Is that what usually happens when you're talking about production companies? And
yeah, I mean, exactly. Anyone from the entertainment industry, if that makes sense. So, yeah, exactly like I said. Before, you know, some of the teams we have this year, we have like Survivor has a team, CAA has a team, CBS Amazing Race, we have ESPN Films, Sony Pictures Classic,
okay, I see.
Paradigm, NSYNC, you know, so there's a bunch of team people like that. And then the celebrity match, we have some pretty cool people, Abby Wambach, Alex Morgan, Chris Harrison, host of The Bachelor. We have Damien Bashir, Diego Luna, Ethan Zahn, of course, Jimmy Conrad, Jay Feely. So a mix of sports and soccer celebs, plus some other kind of, TV, movie celebs.
So, Ethan, what do you think is your ultimate goal for this grassroots soccer? Where do you want to see it in the next 10 years?
In the next 10 years, I would really like to see grassroots soccer expand and roll out our program to as many places as possible. Obviously in Africa, maybe go down to like Brazil, South America. We've already expanded kind of west into the Ukraine area. So it's a really simple concept. And our bread and butter is our curriculum, which has been evaluated and monitored, and it's proven to work. It can make a difference to turn the tide against HIV. So that's what makes grassroots soccer who we are, and our coaches that are dedicated and trained. So it's an easy model, easy to replicate, and I don't see it, stopping here. It can go anywhere.
Well, I hope that it does. So where can our listeners get involved to donate to grassroots soccer and learn more about you?
Excuse me, repeat that.
Where can our listeners donate to grassroots soccer and find out more information about you?
Yeah, if you want to visit grassrootssoccer.org, totally visit. You know, the event is called LAFest.net. If you're in the Los Angeles area, we encourage you to come to the celebrity game that night, or if you're in the entertainment industry, enter a team. There's still plenty of time. And, I hope to see you there.
Well, I will be in L.A. at that time, in downtown L.A., so I'll have to definitely talk to my business partner. We're going to be doing a lot of cool things out there. I'll have to talk to him, see what happens, and see if we can connect when I'm out in L.A. as well. And Ethan,
you should put a team in.
Oh, yeah. I'll have to talk to G. We'll have Simply G, my co-host on different things. We'll have to say, hey, G, I'll let you know about another event happening. That it must be a crazy week and tons of big things happening in L.A. I hope all my listeners that are in the L.A. area can go out and see Ethan and check out the celebrity soccer game. And again, do you have a Twitter, by the way, Ethan, as well, or a Facebook for people to follow you as well?
My Twitter is at Ethan Zahn, and I have a Facebook fan page. Yep, you can totally connect with me that way.
And any other projects coming up with you right now? Do you have anything else going on?
These are the big projects, but I guess another one would be I wrote and published 3 children's books called Soccer World Adventure. And, I'm always kind of trying to pitch those for people to look at.
Well, you have to come on Author's Corner, Ethan, to talk about those children's soccer books. So I know you're publicist, so don't worry. We'll get it next month for you to come and talk about all the children's soccer books. So I appreciate you calling the program, Ethan, and maybe we'll connect in L.A. I'll stay in touch, and we'll see what happens. All right, take care.
All right, sounds good, buddy.
All right, take care, Ethan. Okay, bye-bye. All right, you're listening to the Total Education Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just... We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, for more information. And I'm really excited to have this guest on, because especially who she's related to, but also the many different things she's doing and how she's helping the community. So I want to welcome the program, Rolanda Watts. You're the niece of Maya Angelou. Rolanda, thanks for calling.
Thank Thank you so much. I am excited to be on your show. Thank you.
Well, I'm excited just talking to you about specifically your background, and you and I are related in certain ways, especially when it comes to radio and I guess getting the whole really addicted to the radio thing, you know, interviewing people, you know. I interview about 16 to 25 people a week, and I enjoy it so much. So,
well, listen, you're in it. You're in it, man. I get to interview a couple of people a week. Mine is once a week, but, you know, it's growing. I'm loving radio. I started in radio before, you know, just tiddling around. I had an internship when I was in college, and it led to television. And it's so nice that you can make complete circles in your life, because I'm coming back and doing the show and having fun with it. I love the medium. And it's a lot of fun talking to people and getting those good stories out.
Well, I really enjoy it. And especially if you would check out my network of shows, Rolanda, you'd say, oh, my gosh, you listen to me one night, I'm completely different than another. And I think that's where where the fan following has come, and different shows and people that listen to one of my shows, it's completely different than and interviewing someone like yourself. Like when I talk education talk, I mean, we're talking about specific things that are going on in our public education system. I'm absolutely just passionate as can be, and you know, and debating people and the different things. But when I come to talk to people, especially how they're giving back in the community. So tell us a little bit, Rolanda, about your background, more than your radio host, but much, much more. And then we'll get right to the art of giving, of your community giving.
Oh, sure. Well, I grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I was a little country girl who played in the creek and, you know, rode horses and, you know, dreamed a lot. And I also talked a lot. And my father would give me a microphone and a tape recorder and say, go in there and tell the story. And go in your room, tell the story, and I'll listen to it later. And it's so funny because now I look at what I used to do for play that I do for my living. Most of my life I've had a microphone in front of me. I grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and always had a dream of being on television, even when I didn't see a lot of people in the 1960s who looked like me on television. I just found that it was such a fascinating medium. I remember seeing when Kennedy was shot and when Martin Luther King was shot, my parents cried, and I knew the power that that television had. And I said, I want to tell stories like that. So the real common thread is being in electronic media and also telling stories. I went to Spelman College, where I majored in theater arts and English, and I minored in communications. Then I went and got a master's of science degree in journalism at Columbia University in New York City, Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And then I have an honorary doctorate for the stories that I've told that have helped change lives. And have hopefully, well, the Winston-Salem State University gave me an honorary doctorate because of my humane letters, which basically means that I'm out there helping people, whether it's through my stories or through my community efforts, and I'm really honored to have received that. So I started out in news. I was an investigative reporter and did lots of feature stories as well. I worked for New Jersey Network. I was one of the first duo women anchor teams in the country. I started my career back in the 80s with New Jersey Network and WABC, WNBC. Many people in New York remember me as an eyewitness news reporter with ABC Eyewitness News. I was an anchor woman and reporter for many years. And then from there, from my journalism world, I went to talk shows. And I did Attitudes on Lifetime Television back when there were only three stations, remember. You may not remember that.
No. Wow. Yeah, I mean, again,
three networks. And so Lifetime was a budding new station. It was a station for women, a channel just for women, and it was exciting. And I was working there, and then the show was canceled, and I didn't know what to do. And then a man named Roger King, who discovered Oprah Winfrey and put Wheel of Fortune, Jeopardy, in an Inside Edition, said, come work for me. I worked for him as a senior correspondent, weekend anchor for Inside Edition, working with Bill O'Reilly and the crew.
Oh, wow.
And traveled all over the world, and then one day, Roger King came to me and he said, I want you to do a talk show. He said, you've got a lot more to say than in just a few minutes.
We can tell that. That's definitely only a 14-minute interview, Rolando. You're going to have to be a regular monthly guest on my show, and I'm sure
you... I know. I'll keep it tight, but that's life. So then after the talk show, then I came out to Hollywood, and I've been acting and writing and producing and doing voiceover work. You hear me on Judge Joe Brown going, bad boys on the next Judge Joe. That's me.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
I'm Professor Wiseman on Curious George, would you like to go to the museum? That's me. And I also have my radio show, Sundays with Rolanda.
Oh.
But I tell you what, of all the things I do, and I know you want me to get to this, and I'm happy to do this, you've got to give back. I've been very blessed. I was blessed by people in my community who cared about me. I had scholarships because somebody cared about my education. And so being able to give back is important to me. One of the things that we did Christmas before last, we launched our Children of Our Troops. And basically I had run into a soldier, and I said to the soldier, I said, what can we do on the home front to help you? And it was around the holiday time, and he was about to be deployed, and he said, just be Santa for my kids. And I thought about how I can't imagine waking up on Christmas morning and not having Dad there to help me with the bike, or Mom to make those special pancakes. And this is the sacrifice our children are making for us to be free, too. And so I said, well, I'll rally the Hollywood troops, and we will help the U.S. troops. And we did a tremendous fundraiser. We had Mercedes behind us, Audi, the major banks behind us, insurance companies. The community came out, and we had toys for tots for days.
Wow.
And the Marines came out. It was just wonderful. I also am very concerned that 1 out of 5 American women, which means 1 out of 5 Americans, because when a woman can't read, a family can't read, 1 out of 5 of us can't read. And we're talking about adults who can't read. So I worked in New York City with the Literacy Volunteers group for many years, and I want to continue that work here in Los Angeles. You know, United Negro College Fund, I went to Spelman College. That's very important to me that my community understand how important a college education is. So, you know, I'm always trying to give back where I can. I just was in Delaware speaking with young women about HIV and AIDS. You know, it really breaks my heart that in 1980, when this thing first started, we were talking about it. We're still talking about it. It's a big killer, particularly among women. So I'm just, you know, out there with a big mouth trying to do big things and make a big difference in little bitty ways here and there, like we all are trying to do.
Amen, Rolanda. Amen for what you're doing. And I want to go, and you'll see me as a talk show host. Now I'm going to kind of get into your brain for the short amount of time we have left. And like I said, I'm going to invite you on as being a monthly guest on my show. I'd be honored if you would be, because of so many of your stories, our audience on the celebrity show would just be into it so much, especially back in the day with Bill O'Reilly and all that. I'm sure you'd be interested in talking about that. It seems like you're a talker that enjoys, just like myself.
I love telling a good story, and I got plenty to tell, and I would love to join you, but you have to come on my show too.
Oh, I would be an absolute honor to be on your show. Absolutely. We'll have to make that happen. And then we'll maybe connect when I'm out in LA.
Absolutely.
So let's go specifically to going into this art of community giving. Was it just something that, because of your being also the niece of Maya Angelou, you knew that giving had to be really a part of your repertoire, especially if she would come back, especially when you're telling you call her auntie in so many ways and stuff as well?
Well, you know, it has just been a part of my life. My family has always been about giving. There is an endowment fund in my mother's name, Dr. Velma Watts, at Wake Forest University, because of the work that she did in terms of helping women and minorities and international students become doctors. So my family has always been that way. We've always been very charitable. That has always been expected of us. And my mother and father have always taught us that to whom much is given, much is required. And there were Christmases we took, we fed poor families, or we would take fruit baskets to poor families. That was very important for my family. And also I was always involved in schools that were very much about giving back to the community. My community in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, was very philanthropic. Lots of people had a lot of money because of the tobacco industry, and people were very much into how can we use our gifts and our abundance to help others. So that has been, whether it's school or my community, the Girl Scouts, or the Glee Club, or the Jack and Jill, whatever I was involved with, it was reinforced that you always give back to your community, that you each one reach one and teach each one. That's what we do. So that has always been part of my life, and I will continue, you know, till the day I'm gone, and hopefully what I leave behind will continue to help others as well.
One thing that I try to do with my network is, especially when I bring celebrities on, is I want to talk about their foundation or charity. A lot of times people don't give them the time or effort to really explain what makes them passionate. They want to hear about their latest project. They want to hear about this certain thing when they get interviews, but they never are able to kind of delve into truly what, why, hey, you know, you have this celebrity status, I'm going to utilize it so I can bring awareness to a certain foundation or charity. So tell us specifically, are there any upcoming projects right now with the Art of Community Giving that you're doing right now? Do you have a fundraiser coming up or anything?
You know what? The Art of Community Giving was started in Chicago, and it was started by my friend Monica Haslip, who runs the Little Black Pearl Workshop. It's an art school there. And part of the community effort was brought together because of so many shootings that were going on in Chicago, so many young people getting caught in the crossfire of this horrible gun war, whatever the reason was. But Chicago has been really crippled by such violence. And we thought that when kids see the community coming together, that maybe that means something, that maybe the more efforts that we do and getting those children into art school and off the streets and that type of thing might make a difference. One of the exciting things that we did in Chicago that I would like to bring to Los Angeles and maybe make this part of the literacy effort, I'm not sure, but I just think it's so important. It was one of the most fun things that we got people for $300. You could sponsor a student who was off to school, and you could fill up their trunk. You know, this $300 bought a bedspread, you know, stuff to college kids,
yes.
A bedspread, a radio, you know, a flashlight, all those little things that they need. And when they came to the church parking lot to pick up their trunk that someone had sponsored, they got to meet the family standing behind the that was giving them the tide and the, you know, all the things. That was basically a community person looking at this needy child saying, "I got you. I got you. You're not alone." There's so many families that are hurt right now, whether it's the economy, whether it's some kind of change, whether it's HIV/AIDS, or
yes,
whether it's the drug war. There are families that are in crisis right now, and anything that we can do in our communities to let our families in crisis know that we got you, I think that's a good effort. Some people give money, some people give time. You know, but give where you can, how you can, to somewhere, somehow.
So do you have basically a website involved in the Los Angeles area so that people can get involved and be and help out in your cause?
You know what? You know, I can my website is Rolonda.com, R-O-L-O-N-D-A, and I have a really exciting venture to tell you. I'm going to be launching Row Magazine, and we're going to be talking about all of this, and they'll have more places where you can connect, whether you're interested in the literacy project or you're interested in the Art of Community Giving with the kid, you know, however, whatever that project is going to be under that umbrella this year. And also, of course, the opportunity to help our kids during the holidays is always fun. But there's always something going on, and I agree with you. I really applaud what you're doing because you've got people who are out here doing wonderful things, and you're right. These are the stories that don't always see the light. And you learn so much about folks that, like Nancy O'Dell, one of our big entertainment reporters, she's a great person to talk with. She grew up with the person in her family who was mentally challenged, and now her big charity is and his name was Buddy. So she does the Buddy Foundation, where she helps mentally challenged people who were like her cousin live in a world and, you know, try to live throughout the discrimination and the tough lives that they have. But it is a wonderful opportunity to hear the stories of people, because a lot of this tells a lot about who they are. And, you know, you and I love stories, and one story can change a life, you know?
And I just wish that they would have that time. And like I said, I've had people, all types of celebrities as well on my show. And I'm very impressed, because, again, when I was checking out your bio, I was just checking out, you know, pretty much your one-page pitch. And I'm like, wow, if I knew all this, I could have about 16,000 topics for Rolanda to come on my show. And I mean, just the experience, and to really have a mentor like yourself to kind of keep in touch with, especially as a journalist like yourself, to learn from. That's the key thing. I think that, I mean, any profession you're in, any type of thing, you always want to ask feedback. You always want to look for how to improve, and also make contacts and connect each other in specific ways, Rolanda. And I think it's tremendous. So any other upcoming projects you have? The magazine, I'm really looking forward to help promote that for you. But anything else going on?
Yeah, it's a crazy time. I also have a novel that'll be coming out hopefully this summer. And we have a new movie, a bunch of movies you can go and check out. Just put me in on Netflix and a bunch of movies will come up. But there's a really great one coming out at the end of the summer. It's called House Party. We shot it in South Africa, in Cape Town, South Africa. It is the continuum of that wonderful franchise that Kid and Play started years ago.
I was a huge fan of that.
And listen, and I play the voracious cougar who chases those boys all through the house party. So it's a fun movie. It's great music. It's great dancing. And Warner Brothers is behind it, and that movie will be coming out this summer. In the meantime, you can go pick up Broken Roads, A Mother's Love, 25 Hill, I Will Follow You Into the Dark, House Arrest. These are all movies that you can get on Netflix right now. You can go and download and have a whole Rolanda night.
Amazing. You're amazing, Rolanda. I appreciate you coming on the show. Again, your website's Rolanda.com for more information. Do you have a Twitter, by the way?
Absolutely. Now, listen, you know I love social media, so follow me on the Rolanda fan page. That's R-O-L-O-N-D-A. That's Rolanda fan page on Facebook. I'm Rolanda Watts on Twitter. I'm Rolanda Watts on Instagram and LinkedIn. And you can also follow my radio show at www.sundayswithrolanda.com.
Well, definitely stay on the air, on the line after we finish this interview, just so I can touch base with you. We can get contact information and make sure we can try to network, especially with all the celebrities we both interview. We need to kind of trade back and forth and get interesting people both ways, because you never know how we find them.
What do we say? I got you.
All right. Well, thanks again for calling, and good luck to you. All right, take care.
Okay. The same to you. Thank
Bye-bye.
You so much.
Bye-bye. All right, you're listening to Total Education Celebrity Show. We'll be back in just... So that's not fair. And I bet you also our guest, which I'm really excited about, because I did talk to Don Collier and learned a lot about High Chaparral, and look forward to learning about how Henry created his brand, all the exciting things he's done in his career. So I want to welcome the program celebrity Henry Darrow. Henry, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, Henry, so specifically enough, tell our audience basically how you broke into the business. How did you start out, your childhood, things like
that? Well, I acted as a kid down usually in New York at the auditorium, and I played a hunter. The first, I must have been about six or seven in kindergarten, and as the years passed by, there was a teacher in one of the public schools when I was going in New York, Mrs. Levine, I remember, and she called my mother in and said, your son seems to have a talent for acting and reading, and that's how I started. I got it all together, and my mother in particular was very supportive, and she was good, and she was the one who gave me incredible support.
Well, that's fantastic. I know how important it is to have that support and the right people around you. And for my co-host, G.J. Reynolds, he knows about surrounding himself with the right people, right, G?
Absolutely. I wouldn't be where I'm at today without having the right people around me. And, you know, I have a team of people around me that all do different functions and basically keep me in line, keep me focused so I can do what I can do well. And sounds like Harry, you know, did that. right, or Henry did that right out of the gate.
So yeah, my mom and my mom was it was right during World War II, and she was working, and my father was working at a plant, and one of my aunts would take me into an auditorium and say, "Find your class," and we kept moving up down from 168th Street to 171st to 177th to 180th. Because they were moving into the neighborhood, and they was us Puerto Ricans.
So that's quite interesting. So how did you kind of get once you knew that you had the acting bug? What was the next step to move you forward?
Well, I wound up acting in high school programs, and then I went to the university in Puerto Rico, because my parents were born in Puerto Rico, and I was raised part of my years there. And I went to the only English theater class there, run by an actor, Puerto Rican, Juano Hernandez. And Juano Hernandez had been up for an Oscar nomination in Intruder in the Dust, and he was on Broadway in Othello, etc. And I became, as a teenager, I got to read a little bit of Othello with him. I played Iago to his Othello. So it was quite an experience. And at that time, back in the 40s, the actors that I admired were people like Paul Muni. I don't know if you remember him, but he used to be in a lot of historical dramas that were being filmed at Warner Brothers by William Dieterle, and he did films like The Life of Emile Zola and Louis Pasteur and Juarez, and so it turned out okay. It turned out okay.
Well, it definitely does seem like it turned out okay, and very interesting your background coming.
I faced a hard thing in the beginning of my career, because Delgado is a Latin name, and I just didn't look Latin enough. They say, "No, come on, you're Jewish. You're Jewish. You're not a Latin." And I was like, "Okay." And my first agent said, "You got to change your name from Henry Delgado to Hank Delgado." And then it was all of a sudden Frank Delgado. And I got an agent who said, no, let's look through the phone book." And we found that Darrow, there weren't that many Darrows. And so I changed my name to Henry Darrow, and I wound up auditioning for Manolita Montoya in the Western High Chaparral from 1967 to 1971, and it was a pretty good series. I was the first Hispanic playing prime time, and the first Latino star in the series. I was one of the top five, and I auditioned for it. There was the head of casting from the network, and David Dortort, the producer of Bonanza, also produced High Chaparral, and so it's been a good run. I've had a good run. I've gone from different series and soap operas, and then I wound up doing Zorro three different times. Once was for a producer from CBS. An animated series called Zorro. There was Zorro, there was Tarzan, and there was Superman. And I replaced Fernando Lamas. And when I read for Lou, CBS producer, the network had said, "Henry, he plays it too sexy. You got to play it straight." And so instead of saying "Buenas noches, señorita," I just say "Buenas noches, señorita," and that was it.
Well, GJ, it seems like Henry created his brand by people telling him specifically how to form it and form his whole persona. I mean, before saying...
Exactly. All the interviews that I did, they sort of created and came up with different labels. I did a series called Zorro and Son for CBS, and I got to wear Guy Williams' wardrobe, which was 3 inches long on me. And then I played the father of Zorro with Duncan Regeer. And play his father had more freedom playing the father to Zorro, which was great. And then, of course, I guest starred in all the different dramas and stuff, and I wound up winning an Emmy for the popular Santa Barbara. And the most challenging thing about working in a daytime soap opera is, to be honest, memorizing. I mean, just before every day, you'd be handed a script with changes, and the most satisfying thing about that kind of work was working with the cast. And, you know, I worked with people like Anthony Quinn and Rita Moreno and stuff, and working with Tony Quinn on his set, it was the most quiet set that I've ever filmed at, and that was just a rehearsal.
Oh, wow.
You weren't allowed to talk. He wouldn't allow anybody to speak.
All right, GJ.
Well, yesterday,
go ahead.
Yesterday, Henry, I was at Universal Studios, and I was going down. They were showing, you know, some of the old and the new sets, and they had all the old Western sets, and I was thinking about you because I knew we were going to interview you today, and I was thinking the High Chaparral and Zorro, and I remember watching that show with my grandparents and, you know, my grandfather. It was like his favorite show.
He was great.
When High Chaparral went off the show, I never saw him cry over it, but he was to that point. He's like, that's my favorite show. And so we'd watch it together. And, you know, so you provided a lot of great happy moments. And yesterday I felt like I was a child again, living, you know, going through the old studio and seeing how it was
going. Yeah. And this will be about our 43rd reunion in Tucson. I'm one of two or three that are still alive, kicking around, and I'll be 80 soon. But I'm in fairly good shape. I'm not too bad, and I just hope I can last the 3 days of the events. But we'll be selling photos and selling biographies. The one that Jan Pippins wrote. Called Lightning in the Bottle, and that's my 50 years in the biz. And but you know, you start off small. I started off the first 12 years in Puerto Rico. I gave myself 5 years from Puerto Rico, and then the 5 years were up, and I gave myself another 5 years. And those 10 were gone, and I said, "What the heck? I'll give myself another 5." And I wound up doing a play called The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit, a Ray Bradbury play on Coronet Boulevard in Hollywood. And the producer of Bonanza, David Dortort, saw me and remembered me. And about 9 months later, called me to be in a Western called High Chaparral. And, man, did that change my career.
And so you really like to connect with the fans, don't you? It must be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. I had a lot of fun. And I was raised in the restaurant business and worked for my dad when he ran the faculty club at the university back home in Puerto Rico. So I got to meet a lot of people, and we got used to dealing with the public, so to speak. But there's nothing like dealing with the fans. And then in the first year of Chaparral, you just do what you're told. And then by the second and third year, you know that you take your kids and you take your wife and you go first class, and there's nothing wrong with that.
I don't want to put GJ on the spot, but what is his favorite moment, either in Zorro or High Chaparral, GJ? What did you enjoy the most?
You know, I don't know about, you know, one I enjoyed the most. I just enjoyed the whole series. It was just, you know, it was obviously, you know, you had a variety of Westerns at that time. And
Chaparral, there were about 30 to 50.
Yeah, they were just knocking them out one after another.
Yeah, the Rebel, the Warner Brothers had the Cheyenne with Clint Walker. Oh, man, and then the one with Jimmy Garner, Have Gun Will Travel, and the Rebel. Oh, there were series after series. And the lucky thing was that if you played as a guest star on one of the Westerns at Warner Brothers, everybody got to see the dailies at Warner Brothers, and then you'd be on one, and then, by God, they'd hire you for one of the other Westerns. couple of times I got hired, and I was too small for Clint Walker. He was 6'5", and it was like, nah, he looks like he's going to pick on you. You guys get into a fight. So, we'll have to back you up with two or three other guys.
So
that happened.
So, G, you were saying basically the memories just are basically the Westerns. You enjoyed the whole Western scene and stuff like that, of watching it with your
parents. Yeah, and then gradually the Westerns petered out, and then it became detectives, and then it became doctor shows. There was a show called Mod Squad, and then there was Mission Impossible that I did, and then Kojak. There were a bunch of shows that that came and went. But it was good. I mean, you went from show to show. That was the greatest thing. And then it took me about 9 months to 10 months to lose the identity with Manolito from High Chaparral before other shows would hire me, because they would say, well, people will remember you from the Western, and they won't concentrate on the show. And it turned out okay. I wound up doing different series. Harry O with David Janssen. We shot that down in San Diego, and then the different versions of Zorro, where I played Zorro's father, Duncan Regier. We shot that in Spain over 3 years, and he's the most disciplined actor I've ever worked with. He worked out for 2.5 to 3 hours every morning before he was picked up to go to the studio. He was an excellent horseman, a fine swordsman, and it was a half-hour show, and we hit it off. It worked well. I replaced Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., and he used to like to play golf, but it was so hot in Madrid, where he played, that he decided not to come back for the next year, and that was my opening.
Wow. So very interesting career, Henry, and I think that always, every year, going to the High Chaparral reunions, a lot of fun, and connecting with people and things like that. So, Henry, where can they find more information on what you do and also about the High Chaparral reunion?
Okay. There's the book called Lightning in the Bottle by Jan Pippins and myself, and it's available from any fine online retailers, and that's at www.henrydarrowbook.com. And there are videos and photos of a thing I did called Soda Springs, which was a modern Western. I hadn't been on a horse for, oh, God, decades. And all of a sudden, I stayed on this horse for 2.5 hours. And they had to help me get off. And they said, well, we'll help you get off, and then you can get back on. I said, no. You have to take me to the hotel, because I am so sore that I cannot walk. And they made that possible.
Now,
but it was a good
exactly
show.
Well, Henry, one thing that GJ does all the time, and before we let Henry leave, you have to tell him something, right? Ask him a question, right, G?
Well, the question is, what is your goal for the next 90 days, your 90-day challenge? So we have
to... I'll be going to Tucson from the 22nd through the 24th of this month. And then after that, there's an event at the end of June, the Memphis Film Festival, June, 13th, 14th, and 15th of the next month. And I'll be there selling pictures and selling the book. And it's coming along. I'm not dowdy yet. But I have a little pain in one leg, and I use a cane on occasion, and sometimes I don't. But I work out of the gymnasium 3 days a week, so I'm in fairly good shape.
Well, Henry, we really appreciate you coming on the show, and GJ has a lot of fond memories of watching High Chaparral and Zorro. So thanks again for calling, Henry.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. You're listening to the Beach Lifestyle Show with host GJ Reynolds and myself, Neil Haley, and we'll be back. We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, for more information. It could be on one of the other shows as well, because we love these interviews, and we want to get our audience all over the world to listen to the celebrity segments. And I want to welcome the program Steve Doucette, celebrity Steve Doucette, and you are involved in Yellow Rock and much, much more. Steve, thanks for calling.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Absolutely. So, Steve, let's first of all go to your background, your career in Hollywood and everything, and what led you to Yellow Rock.
Well, I actually started off back in the 80s doing stand-up comedy. I had my little brother, Joe Doucette, and we had a stand-up comedy team called The Other Brothers. And so that was my first, experience with any kind of show business. We had kind of a song and dance vaudeville kind of act. And that's where we met Drew Carey, and that's where I got my first writing lesson.
Oh, wow.
From Drew Carey. And this is, of course, way before he ever became famous. And so if Drew's out there listening, how you doing, bud?
Well, definitely, you have to help me introduce me to him, so I'll get him on the show. We'll see what happens. So,
absolutely. And so, you know, I met Lenore when I came out here to California. Lenore Andrell is my producing partner. She's the leading lady in Yellow Rock, a tireless producer and a great writer. And so we both, started writing. We had worked on scripts before, but we came up with this concept to do a Western, and everything took off, and everything just started falling into place. You know, these things are not easy, but we were really blessed with just being fortunate and getting some good people to work with.
Here's the question, Steve, that really is interesting in the whole process. Why Westerns? What got you into this, hooked on this as much as the others?
You know, I wish I could sit here and say that, you know, we were clever and we saw the curve coming, but we didn't. We just simply wanted to make an independent movie, to try and showcase some of Lenore's talents. And everything kind of blew up from there. It got bigger. And that's when I decided to make this more of a Western, because it was going to be easier for us to shoot, especially when you're shooting at the Values Day Motion Picture Ranch. You've got all of your one-stop shopping right there. So everything for our locations was right in one place. And that was really important. So we kind of stumbled into the Western thing. I mean, I've always loved Westerns, but, you know, once I said, hey, let's make this a Western, everybody, you know, especially my partner, of course, thought that was a great idea. And that's kind of how we got into it. We really stumbled into it. And now Westerns are making that kind of a comeback. You know, they're all over the place now.
Yeah, I've noticed that, and then it was funny. I had Don Collier on the show today from High Chaparral. So we're really going from different generations in this, Steve, and it's very interesting. That's how we were able to connect Yellow Rock, thanks to High Chaparral. They were able to connect me over to you guys.
Well, you know, High Chaparral, those are the kind of shows that I was teased on. You know, growing up with shows like Gunsmoke, High Chaparral, The Rifleman, all of these stories that we grew up with, you know, in the 60s, you know, were very message-oriented. You know, they always had some moral to their stories, you know. And so that's what Lenore and I wanted to do with our movie. We wanted to make a fun Western, but we also wanted to make sure that it did have some kind of a message and would make people think a little.
All right. So I guess, again, it takes place in California. And what I think that it's also historically based in so many aspects. And one of the things I got from one of your actors is really that you really depicted the Native Americans in the right way. And you really were looking at history in this whole process, weren't you?
Which was so important to us. You know, one thing that we wanted to do in making a Western was make it authentic and real. And that meant the cowboys and the Native Americans. So having, you know, Michael Spears and Eddie Spears, two of the top Native American stars in Hollywood, not just, you know, in your movie, but really there to help consult, making sure that we had everything, you know, the right way. And so we felt really comfortable, you know, having those guys on set, making sure that we had the whole Native American thing down right. And, of course, Peter Sciarrico and Caravan West, you can't make a Western without this guy. Peter Sciarrico played Farley in the movie, and he supplied all the Western gear, the authentic gear. Maybe you and Lenore got into that conversation yesterday, I don't know. But he was instrumental in making sure that our movie was authentic.
No, I'm trying to direct you in a different direction. When I try to interview creative ends and people, everyone that's involved, it's more about specifically your part of this. I think that Lenore was able to give me different things, and Joe, Bill and Jerry was able to give me specifics. That's where I kind of direct my questions and different things. I guess the thought process is that one of the reasons why a Western is your love of Westerns when you're growing up. So you really did have a lot of prior knowledge to understand what needed to the feel and the look of what a Western needed to be.
Absolutely. And, you know, and that's, you know, to say that I'm a Western fan would be a huge understatement. You know, those are the, you know, my favorite kind of movies. And so that really helped both Lenore and I when we were, you know, writing the script out. We wanted to do something as a Western that had more of a throwback to the way movies were made, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. The difference being is we think that our movie is much more authentic than the gear and the things that they used in that. So anything that, you know, that we grew up with as kids definitely inspires you for what you want to do in the future. And that's the way we felt about it. So what I brought to the table was this idea of developing the characters and to do a good Western. And of course, the money, which is, you know, a big thing. You've got to have the money to shoot your movie. I served as the executive producer and co-writer, and that's what I brought to the table there. And, you know, it's funny. They told me, you know, just come out there and sit in a chair and, you know, and watch this everything unfold. But, you know, when you're out there on the set and you're shooting an independent film, all of a sudden you find yourself doing everything from, you know, helping other actors or directors or doing craft services, whatever it takes.
And, again, to shoot a film for our audience out there that, you know, had never been in this predicament, it's a lot of work. It's not a, okay, it takes 2 days, you're done. No, the frames and everything involved in this, I think that's important for our audience to know, too.
Well, again, you're absolutely right. It's not the glamour that you would think it is. And quite frankly, as I thought that it might be, you know, because this was the first time that I had a chance to produce a movie like this. Fortunately, again, the people that I surrounded myself with were very experienced, and we were able to pull this off. But quite frankly, the real miracle is being able to do all this in the short amount of time. To do a feature film and shoot it in 12 days is amazing.
I mean, I 12 days, there goes something I did not know. Why is that? Because of the amount of funding you had? You had to shoot.
Yeah, you're always working on a schedule, and that schedule's got to match up with the location. It's got to match up with the other actors who've got other gigs that they've got to move on to. And so you've only got this short window of time to try and shoot your movie. And that's just the way it is. And if you have to go over, it's going to cost you more money. So what we were able to accomplish in that short period of time is quite remarkable from people that I've talked to that have been in this industry a lot longer than myself.
It sounds like it, and it's quite remarkable. And then I guess the most quite remarkable thing that it's great we're getting your basic description of what happened and retelling the story, because, Steve, the funniest thing about this is you're telling me you shot it in this many days, but the amount of awards and the talk about how great a movie it was, that must have blown you away. You thought, okay, I only have this amount of money to do this. Let's get it done. And then to see the feedback, it must have been very, very rewarding and humbling at the same time.
You said it. And I'll tell you, again, where I come in to help this project, you know, get where it is a lot of it comes in post-production, because you want to start skimping on your movie, whether it's on sound or color, you know, or the musical score. And so that's where, you know, we did not want to spare any expense. And that's why Yellow Rock has got that great production value deserves.
And that's so important. And I just could imagine. So when you got all the awards, what was the thought when you were getting up, I guess, nominated for these, and you said, and people were saying, this is so great. Were you shocked when finally you heard, wow, they're really speaking highly of this?
Yeah, because, you know, when you're making a movie, the first thought is, hey, let's just get this thing in the can. You know, and even though there were other producers on set like Daniel Valuzet who predicted that we were going to win these awards, it was the farthest thing from my mind. And so even being nominated for something was quite a thrill, and winning, especially something like, you know, the Heritage Awards, where we swept, and being in the company with movies like Unforgiven, Dances with Wolves, High Wow. Noon, you know, I mean that blew us away. So, you know, we had to fly out to Oklahoma City and meet some wonderful people at the Western Heritage Museum. And you bet, man, that floored us. You know, now it felt like, you know what, we did something important.
So here's the question, Steve, because not everyone has seen the movie. Is there an opportunity for a release after the DVD to once, because of how many awards, sometimes these things happen, then they get put out there again for more of an audience, or what is the plan?
Well, this is not a theatrical release movie. It is available now. You can buy Yellow Rock on Amazon.com, Walmart.com, or in the Walmart stores, Blockbuster.com, Barnes & Noble, streaming, Redbox. It's all over the place. Our distributors feel like this little movie is going to have legs for a while, which is always good to hear.